Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 294, and we're going to talk about driving and mindfulness. Is there a connection? I think there is, and I think it's one that we've known for a very long time. We're also going to talk about, fuel a little bit, because oh my... A product review of something to keep those biting skeeters away, and a lot of talk about different stones for some reason. It's stone time. It is. It's officially stone time. Did you know that? So, thanks for tuning in once again. Very happy to be here with you. I just came off of a long trip, as I mentioned last week. I was gone about 3 weeks total, and during that time, I got very little done in regards to keeping up with email, filing taxes, all this kind of stuff that I have to do in normal life. And it's because I was in a state of in transit. I was in transit. And I've talked about this before. I talked about the book Pilgrim at Tinker's Creek, which somebody gave to me when I was in college, and inscribed in the cover was, "It is better to travel than arrive," which is something I've thought of ever since. So thank you, Noel, once again, for giving me that book. You have given me something to think about for decades. I appreciate that. But mindfulness is, well, it's a bit of a buzzword. To be clear, what we're talking about here is mindfulness. It's being present. Now, there might be a whole bunch of different interpretations of mindfulness, just like minimalism or whatever. It's one of these words that's thrown around and not necessarily nailed down. But the concept of mindfulness as I know it is based on a Buddhist practice called Vipassana, which it's about awareness. It's about being intentful and being purposeful and not just going along with the flow necessarily, not letting your emotions guide you. Being thoughtful in a way, but not about other people so much, although that's part of it, but just being thoughtful about where you are in this point in time and what you're doing. And there is a snail trying to escape from my little tank. Why are you doing that, little guy? You won't like it out here in the real world. You want to be in the tank. See, the snail here is in transit, but it's not going to be too happy about it. Okay, anyway, I put him back home, and I hope he realizes that staying in the tank is good for him. Many of you have had this experience where driving lets you be kind of in a different space than sitting at your desk or sitting on someone's couch or wherever you might be in life. There's something about driving that puts us in a different state of mind, and arguably that carries forth through all of van life. And I've noticed this many times. I've noticed this as a kid. I mean, when my dad was upset about something, he used to say, "I'm going to go for a drive," you know, and clear his head. Well, why go for a drive to clear your head? Why not just go to another room or go in the backyard? Or, I mean, there are other ways to do it, but there's something about driving. The fact that it requires a level of focus, but not complete focus, that is interesting for how our brains work. Now, to be clear, I'm not saying you shouldn't pay attention while driving. Of course, that is important. But after you've been driving for several years, a lot of the motions of driving are just automatic muscle memory. Like, I don't have to think, oh, I'm turning left up here. I should put on my turn signal now. It just happens. And when I step on the brake, it's not because I thought, oh, I should step on the brakes. It just happens. Now, obviously, some part of my brain is thinking, step on the brakes, step on the gas, all that kind of stuff. But it is a pre-conscious part of my brain. It is not at the forefront of my focus, which it was when I first learned how to drive, right? That's another Buddhist concept, the beginner's mind, where you're so present that every little action you do is very much in focus. But that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that when you are an experienced driver, and driving is, as they say, second nature, that puts you in a mind state that is mindful. And this can happen with other things. It's not just driving. Some people can find this when they're doing the dishes or when they're doing puzzles or crochet. There's something about doing a task where your hands know what to do without you having to think about it that puts you in the state of mind that many people find peaceful, or adding clarity, or letting them figure things out. Another place where this is true, for me especially, is the shower. If I have a problem to solve, I will take a shower. And those are not just problems of hygiene, I'm talking about just any problem. If I, like, don't have an answer for something, I find that if I take a shower, I often will come up with an answer in the shower. Why? Why is it possible to do that in the shower rather than sitting at my desk where I have all these resources available? I'm not exactly sure. I'm no psychologist, and I'm sure people have written papers on this, but I can just tell you from my experience that it's true. Somehow, limiting your ability to do things makes it easier to think new thoughts, solve problems, and be creative. And I have a bunch of examples of this. When I first started the College of Curiosity 15 years ago or whatever, I needed a logo, and I came up with a logo that you guys probably haven't seen unless you've known me for a long time. It just says the words College of Curiosity with this fancy font that does all kinds of crazy things. It's too busy, and I stopped using it in favor of the Hook Walk a Bang logo a long time ago, but I needed a logo, wasn't sure what to do, and I built this thing, and then as I was looking at it, I thought, this is supposed to be about curiosity. This needs more. And I couldn't figure out what to do. And then I was on an airplane staring at my computer that was not hooked up to the internet. And it came to me so simply that what I needed to do was animate it. It needed to be an animated logo where at the top of the page, little things would move in the logo, which was just words after all. So I had one letter spin and all kinds of stuff like that. Anyway, it came out nice. I liked it. I don't use it anymore. That's not the point. The point is that I could not have thought of that unless I was sitting on a plane in a restricted place where I didn't have all these options. It's similar with driving. When you're driving, you are forced to pay sustained attention to a thing, and that is driving. Or you and others will die. Yes, there are high stakes when you're driving. If you do it badly, very, very bad things happen. So you do it, and you're focused, and your hands are on the wheels, and you're scanning the horizon, and you're speeding up and slowing down as appropriate, keeping the vehicle within the lanes, and all those little tasks that you've done countless times before set you up for a blank slate. A bit of your brain that is now free. It doesn't have to do anything else. It's not having to worry about paying the bills because it can't do that right now. It's not having to think about scrolling Facebook because you can't do that right now. All you can do is drive, and then there's a spare space that you can fill with thoughts. And that's a rare thing today with digital life. And it's actually getting even rarer while driving with CarPlay and things like this, where text messages can be read to you or you can talk to AI or whatever. Limiting those distractions is so important now. And the trick for me is they need to be hardly restricted or restricted in a hard fashion is probably a better way to say that. Meaning that I can't just say, okay, I'm going to turn everything off and sit at my computer. No, I actually need the physical barrier. Like, I need to be stuck in an airplane without internet or driving where I physically can't just automatically go and do something else. Because you know what? Those things are muscle memory too. When I get up in the morning, I sit at my computer and Facebook instantly appears on the screen. Not automatically, but because I search for it. And I don't do this consciously. I don't ever think, hey, I'm here. Let's see what's going on Facebook. No, it just happens. And in fact, the times when I've tried to force myself to stay off of Facebook because I have a deadline and need to get something done, I will find that over and over and over again, Facebook is on the screen and there I am looking at it. And I am not having the thought I should go to Facebook. It's just happening automatically. It's a muscle memory. It's a second level of thinking, just like driving is. And so when I'm driving, I can't do that. And I might think, oh, I wonder what's going on Facebook. But that's a different thing. I don't suddenly find myself scrolling Facebook while I'm driving, because that would be bad. And I know that. So having those hard limits really, really helps. Also, we live in an age where everyone expects to be connected all the time, and they expect other people to be connected all the time. How do you feel when you send someone a text message and they don't respond right away? Maybe it's an hour, maybe it's 2 hours, no response. Why are they so rude? Or, boy, I hope something hasn't happened to them, or, you know, whatever. And then, when they finally get back to you and explain, oh, I'm sorry I didn't get back to you sooner, I was driving, You're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That means that driving is a get-out-of-jail-free card for not being connected all the time. People understand that you shouldn't be constantly connected while you're driving. It's socially acceptable. And that alone gives you the freedom to not be connected, which is hard to get if you're just sitting at your desk. I mean, it's such a challenge. It's a boon. I mean, it's nice to be connected all the time. I'm connected to dozens of people all the time, almost all day long, in the Discord channels, on Facebook, text messages, email, whatever. I can just reach out and get information from people thousands of miles away, where in the 1850s, that would have taken months if it was even possible. So we're victims of our own success in that regard, in that we no longer have time to just be, except while we're driving. It's socially acceptable. Also, long drives, kind of, this is my own wording here, I'm not taking this from anybody, you get this carrier wave. And what I mean by that is, if you're going to take a 3-hour drive, you're going to be driving for 3 hours. That is a constant. You have this constant thing that's going on for 3 hours that's going to require usually the same amount of attention. Obviously, if there's a storm or accidents or stuff, you're going to pay more attention. But for those 3 hours, you are in a steady state. And this gives you space to spend longer thinking about things without distractions than you might find in your regular life. It also diffuses stress that way. You don't have these constant interruptions. Bing, bing, bloop, beep, 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 boop, boop. That is all gone away. Or if you do hear those things, they don't have the impact because you know you can't answer them. You do know that, right? You're not supposed to be looking at your phone and texting while you're driving, right? Everyone knows that. Everyone knows that that is just as dangerous as drinking and driving. You do know that. Okay, we're just going to proceed as though everyone knows that. Because if you don't know that, we're going to have a very, very different talk. And I might have to show you some pictures, and they won't be pleasant. Anyway, back on track. The brain can often process emotions and ideas more clearly when the brain is lightly occupied by something like driving or crocheting or puzzle doing, but not overstimulated and not being interrupted. It's that steady state of light activity that puts you in this state where you can just figure things out and figure out who you are, figure out what you're doing in life, etc. But there has to be some change. This is the trick. If you lock yourself in a room, like let's say you locked yourself in the closet and said, hey, that's it, no distractions, I'm locked in the closet, no one's going to be able to bother me here, ha ha, that doesn't work. For some reason, it doesn't work. Driving or crocheting or doing puzzles gives you change as well. You get this low level of predictable change. So you're driving along, the scenery's changing a little bit, you're adjusting things a little bit, that car's getting a little too close, oh, there's a truck up there, I better go to the left-hand lane, etc., etc., etc. All those little things help stimulating your mind to stay on track, and that carries over to whatever thoughts or emotions you're having as well. Your brain just kind of carries them along, like with momentum. Like if you're trying to solve a problem of like, boy, I don't know what I'm going to do next year. Should I go back to school or should I get a job? Whatever. The act of driving, where you're forced to pay a certain level of attention for a certain amount of time, will drag that thought along with it and let you keep working on it without getting pulled away to something else. That's a rare thing in society today. We just don't have lives that allow that. It didn't used to be like that. You know, people used to do boring jobs in factories where they had all day to think. Or I can tell you that when I was driving a tractor back in Utah plowing fields, I had all kinds of time to think about things. But then when I worked at AOL and I had to answer 100, 200 emails a day, that was all I could do. That was literally all I could do. Oh, another one. Bing, bing, bing. Oh, someone's messaging me. You know, my phone's ringing. All this stuff at once. Completely different state of mind. And not necessarily a bad state of mind. I don't mind being in that state, honestly. Sometimes I like it. Like, I will play games of the Command and Conquer type to actually stimulate that, where there's so much going on, I have to give it maximum concentration. But driving lets me be mindful in the sense that I'm just talking about. Some people might actually say that real-time sims like Command and Conquer is a heightened level of mindfulness, but I think that is a different concept, personally. Another thing about driving is that it has a beginning and an end. Usually, I mean, sometimes you'll just drive and you'll end it when you get tired, and then you have a decision to make. But other times you're trying to reach your destination. That sets boundaries. And when you have boundaries, you don't have to think about them. When am I going to stop? Well, I'm going to Nebraska. All right. Well, where are you going to stop in Nebraska? I'm going to stop in Aurora, Nebraska, because I always stop there. I don't even have to think about that until I get there. That whole thing is gone. And I now know that I'm going to be in the car for 8 hours, or the truck, or the RV, or whatever I'm driving. And that also gives me permission to just think about other things. Now, when you take this to a larger scale, isn't van life, at least the way some people are living it, just that kind of thing extended throughout their whole lives? I mean, it could be. It depends on how you do van life. There is no one way to do van life. But I think for some of you, what I'm saying right now is really going to resonate. And you're like, yes, that's it. That's why I'm doing this. I want to have things in this little space that moves around. And so I have this one constant in my life, the van, and then everything else I can change as I want. And that gives me time and freedom to be who I am. Now, if you're having all kinds of problems with your van and you have a deadline, you're trying to get someplace you can't, obviously that's out the window. But if you are, say, a retired person and you've decided you're going to take the summer to explore whatever country you're in, you can see a sense of peace and some room to think and be who you are that you probably couldn't get if you just stayed home and watched TV with your phone in your hand, or even if you were on some kind of an organized tour where you stopped somewhere different every day. I mean, that's what I just came from. I did 3 weeks of a tour where I was in a different country or different place every day. That did not get me in this state. That was like, oh, okay, tomorrow is Menorca. What am I going to do in Menorca? I better do some research. And then, oh, I got to get this thing at the store and I'm out of Advil. I better go to the... All that kind of stuff was just piling in there. Driving doesn't do that to me. I think there's something special about driving. And I know people who don't like driving because they never get to that point. The people who just find driving stressful all the time. And I know several people like this. They just don't understand how I can drive for all these hours because to them, driving is stress. And I don't know if that's because they never got to that zen level of driving, or if just inherently they don't like driving. Maybe they don't like all the responsibility of driving because driving has a lot of responsibility. I don't know. Not everybody's the same, obviously. But for those of us who drive a lot, and I think the van life community has a fair number of them, I think we're practicing a form of mindfulness when we're driving often. And sometimes it's just plain fun. And that's okay, too. Thank you to everyone who keeps ads off this podcast at buymeacoffee.com/built-to-go. That's 2 T's, not 3, not 1. If you would like to keep ads off the podcast, please visit that URL. Buy me some gallons or whatever you would like. Time out here. If you're not familiar with the buy me a coffee concept, the idea is that you will just give a one-time donation, or you can make it recurring if you want, but you can just say, hey, thank you, here's a cup of coffee. And typically it's $5. You take, here's $5, cup of coffee, thanks for the good episode, whatever. That's the whole concept. But the thing lets you pick what you want for gallons. And for years, I had it as diesel because that's what my van took. Now the van's gone. I don't need diesel anymore, except for my tractor, and I'm not asking you guys to buy me diesel for my tractor. So you guys get to pick. Maple syrup was a good one. Thank you for that. I've received many, many gallons of beer. I'm all set there. Be creative. It's all good. And thank you to everyone who has bought me coffee or whatever, and especially the people who do it every month. You are the reason there's no ads on this podcast, and I can stop talking about it right now. Tech Talk. Yeah. Yeah. $6.51 a gallon for diesel. Yes, that is what I saw while I was driving from LaSalle, Illinois to Chicago, Illinois last week. That is the highest price I have ever seen for diesel in the United States. And yes, I understand folks outside the United States are like, what a bargain. And I agree. We have cheap fuel in the U.S. relative to the rest of the world. But this is double what we were paying last year, and I don't care what you're talking about, if something doubles in cost, it's going to make an impact. I also understand that recent events have caused fuel prices to go up around the world, and for that, I can only apologize in that my one vote didn't count. Most of us here in the U.S. do not support any of this that's going on right now. You can look at recent polls for that. But lest we get too much into politics, what do we do about this? I mean, a lot of us had big plans for this summer. We were going to do that one big trip. You know, I would like to go to Newfoundland from Chicago. It's a 5,000-mile round trip about. This is not going to be the year. Now, it wasn't going to be the year anyway because I don't have time, but this would cost me thousands of dollars more just because of the fuel costs. I do not have a magic bullet for this, obviously. There's nothing you can buy to put in your car or truck that's going to help get you magic fuel mileage. Those things that let you use water don't work, the magnets don't work, all the K&N filters, all that stuff doesn't work. Anything that could be engineered to solve this problem is already in your vehicle. Believe me, if Ford could come up with something they could put in their F-150s to make them get 10 more miles a gallon, they would have done it, because what a competitive edge that would give them. I bought my Ram 1500 Classic primarily because of the fuel mileage, and I have to say, I'm still getting 24 miles a gallon on my trip from LaSalle County, Illinois to Chicago that I do almost every week. That's incredible for a truck with a big V8 like it has. Now, here we can get into some practical stuff. How am I getting 24 miles a gallon on a big truck with a V8 5.7 liter Hemi in it? Well, partially it's the way the truck is built. That engine has a special feature that shuts off half the cylinders if it doesn't need them. So I'm essentially driving a four-cylinder truck most of the time, and then when I need extra power, I'm going up a hill or something, it switches to eight-cylinder. So the vehicle inherently does that. But in order for that eco mode to come on, I need to be driving a light load. If I tow a trailer, it's never going to come on. If I have my truck camper on the back, it will never come on. I'm going to be pulling full gas and I'm going to get half as much fuel mileage just because that truck camper's on there. Now, my pod that I have on the back, which is a fiberglass shell that has a floor that sits in the back of the truck, I have that in there most of the time. That's a bit of a compromise. When that's in there, I can get 17 to 18 miles per gallon, depending. So not as good as 24, but nowhere near the 11.5 I was getting with the truck camper. But now that gas prices have gone up so much, I took the pod off. I mean, I'm the kind of person who always wants to have their van, as I call it, with me all the time. I want all my stuff there. I want to be able to cook and sleep and use the bathroom and all that stuff anytime I want, wherever I am, regardless of the circumstances. If I have to go to the supermarket on an errand, I want to be able to get into my van in the parking lot and do whatever I wanted to do. And I have to sacrifice that now, and it's partially because of fuel costs. I'm going to be doing a lot of driving between LaSalle County and Chicago lately. It's 100 miles each way, so that's 200 miles a weekend, which is 200 miles a week, which ends up being about 1,000 miles a month I'll be doing, which is average. That's not a lot of driving. I don't have a daily commute, so that doesn't add into it. But when you start doing the math, when you're doing 1,000 miles a month and gas prices are double, that's a big expense. So this is what I've done. I've taken the pod off. I'm going to work on it on weekends, and I'm not going to put it back on until I go to RMSS in June. So for the next month, I'm going to be driving clean and lean. That truck is going to be getting maximum mileage. But I also had another thought. So driving to Colorado is 1,100, 1,200 miles. You know, it's depending on how I go. That's a long trip, and I have to double that. So 2,500 miles, let's say. And some of it's uphill because I'm at, what, 700, 800 feet above sea level here, and where I go in Colorado is 7,500 or 7,700. I have to go all the way uphill, which means less gas mileage. Why am I bringing this pod thing at all? I mean, why don't I just throw a tent in the back of the truck? I have all the cooking stuff. I could literally just fill up the back of the truck with stuff and go, and then when I get there, I can set up camp and take down camp, and for this kind of trip, that would work perfect. And that feels like cheating, because this is van life I'm supposed to be doing. This is not tent life. But I'm tempted because it would save me literally hundreds of dollars. So the problem really with the gas thing is that there's this constant pressure of like everything I do now costs more, and it dampens everything. And I've talked about this before. There's only two ways that you can spend less money on fuel. One is drive slower, because the aerodynamics of the vehicle cause a lot more drag at higher speeds. Once you get above 50, 60 miles an hour, every mile above that increases drag like twofold. So the drag on a vehicle between 30 and 50 is a little bit more, but the drag on a vehicle between 50 and 70 is a lot more. Your gas mileage will go down drastically if you drive 70 miles an hour instead of 50. Now, 50 miles an hour isn't necessarily going to work. I mean, money is one resource, so is time. And when you're driving long distances, losing 20 miles of speed every hour means you're going to be driving for more hours. And that's not good. Every hour you're driving puts you at more risk, and it's just your time that's going up too. So you're going to have to make decisions about what you're going to do. The other thing is just don't drive as much. You know, don't, like, I'm taking this trip to Colorado. I'm committed to it. I'm doing it. But I could decide not to. That would save me 2,500 miles worth of gasoline. That would be a lot. And if I had the option, I could replace that with another trip. Like, why do I have to go all the way to Colorado? What if I just went to Devil's Tower in Wyoming? That's a shorter distance. That would save me fuel. Interesting place I'd like to go to. Or what if I went to Detroit? I've never been to Detroit, actually. It's one of the few major U.S. cities I've not spent any real time in. As it happens, I am actually planning a trip to Detroit. But, I mean, unfortunately, unless you're the kind of person who can just say, the heck with it, I'm not going to worry about gas prices, it is what it is, this trip's going to cost me an extra $250, I'm not going to think about it. Unless you can be that kind of person, you're going to have to make some decisions. But I do suggest that you make those decisions. Turn this into a positive action, not in the sense that it is like positive meaning good, meaning that you have made a decision. You have done something to control the situation. That will make you feel better about it, and it will actually save you money, depending on what you're doing. I wish I had better news, but I hate to end this on even worse news, but everything I'm seeing says that no matter what happens in the Middle East, this is not going to resolve quickly. Like, if suddenly everyone makes peace and is playing patty cake and everyone's happy, gas prices aren't going to go down immediately. They will probably be a little drop, and then it's going to take as long as 2 years for them to get back down to what we call normal. And honestly, they may never get back down to normal, because why would they? Product review. Finally made it back down to Tiki Bagoland and to start de-winterizing things. I was very late this year. I was like 2 months late, so everything's a mess. All this stuff has grown up, and anyway, I've got a lot of work to do. But one thing I didn't do that's part of my winterizing is to put out mosquito dunks. Now, these are these little donut-shaped things that you can put in stagnant water. And I have two spots that I always put these in. One is like a little pond that's a vernal pool, and the other is a drainage ditch. And they get water in the spring, and it dries up by summer. But in the spring, they're full of water, and the mosquitoes love to breed there. And I put these dunks in there, and the mosquitoes go in and breed, and then there's a bacteria in the dunks that kills the mosquito larvae, and you just have fewer mosquitoes. And this year, I didn't do that, and oh, what a difference. The number of mosquitoes was just incredible. It was like being in the Arctic or in the Everglades. Clouds of mosquitoes. You know, you stick your arm out and there's 20 mosquitoes on there. Well, that's no fun. It's especially not fun for my wife, who is really has a hard time with mosquitoes. Like, every bite turns into a major issue. And so, how do we deal with this? Well, obviously you cover up as much as possible, but eventually, you're going to want to use some insect repellent, probably. There's all kinds of lore and misinformation about insect repellent, but one thing the studies show time and time and time again is a 20 to 25% DEET spray is the best at keeping mosquitoes off of you. I know people like their herbal stuff and the whole skin so soft myth and all that. Everyone's got stories about how they use this stuff and nothing bothered them, but their stories. That's not data. You have to do a formal study to actually know what the situation is. And those formal studies show that DEET as well as Picardin are the two things that actually work. But DEET is not without its problems. There are claims of neurological disorders and all these horror stories. Those are not borne out by the evidence and the data. You can find people saying that, but if you look at the people doing the studies, they're not saying that. They're saying that it's okay. You don't want to drink it. You want to use it as it is directed on the container. But that isn't the worry. The worry is that the stuff is kind of oily, and that it dissolves plastic. This is actually kind of a problem. If you get it on your computer keyboard, it's going to dissolve your keyboard. Not like into liquid, but you might notice that there are permanent fingerprints on your keyboard. Or if you have a watch with plastic on it, it'll kind of soften it. And now that clothes are being more and more made out of plastic, that can be a problem too. So this is not a 100% solution, but Off has a newer, it's been out for a few years, product that helps with this because it's not as oily. And it's called Off Dry, specifically Deep Woods Off Dry. It's in that right range for the DEET. It's the right amount of DEET. But when you spray it on, it doesn't feel like Off. It doesn't feel like insect repellent. It doesn't have that oiliness to it. It sprays on and it just feels dry. It feels almost like antiperspirant. If you ever used a spray on antiperspirant, it feels like that. We've been using it for a couple years now. It is just as effective as any of the other Off products, which means it works, and it reduces the number of bites I get. This is, again, a story, right? Because I'm not doing a study. I'm just me being out there. But my story is that when I use this stuff, I get far, far fewer bites. I was literally outside for hours this weekend with a cloud of mosquitoes around me, and I got a couple of small bites, nothing major, and they went away after a day, which is partially my physiology. But I also think that even if the mosquitoes will bite you, having the repellent on there makes them not stay as long. I don't know if that's true. I've heard you actually want the mosquito to be on there longer because it sucks out some of the anesthetic that you're allergic to. That's actually how it works. Whatever. My anecdote, my story, is that this stuff really helped me from getting bit to death. And at least the DEET part of that is backed up by studies, not just my story. Anyway, I wanted to bring it out to you. I wanted to let you know about this stuff in case you haven't been aware. And I'd also like to let you know that it's pretty darn cheap. You can get the little can for $3.99 on Amazon right now. It's 2.5 ounces. I'll have a link in the show notes. This is the dry stuff. So they make a whole bunch of different stuff now. The one that I think you should try is called Off Deep Woods Insect Repellent, and then 8, it has V111 for some reason. Insect Repellent 8, I don't know why, but dry. It's a dark green can, and it's different than Deep Woods Off, which is an oily stuff. That also works fine. I actually like the smell of it. It reminds me of camping as a kid, but this stuff's much more comfortable and much more kind to any of your plastics because it just doesn't get on the plastic the same because it's dry. Anyway, enough about that. If you hate mosquitoes, which I think you should if you're a human being, this stuff can help. Link in the show notes. Tales from the Road. So I am organizing this very strange trip to Salem, Massachusetts for spring of next year, 2027. End of April, beginning of May. I don't know the dates yet, and I don't know that I want to invite the whole world because this is going to be an unusual trip. It's basically I'm going to take some people around to Salem and reminisce about growing up there and all the crazy little bits of history I learned over the years that you're not going to learn from any tour guide. It is going to completely de-emphasize the hocus-pocus Halloween-y stuff and focus a lot more on the old-time history of Salem, how Salem became a colonial village when originally it was a Native American village, the forts in Salem that people pass by and don't even realize are there, things like that. Salem is, in American terms, a very old place. People have been living there for thousands of years, but even in just U.S. terms, Europeans have been living there since 1626. So that means there's 400-year-old history, European history, in Salem, and that is fairly rare in the United States. And a lot of it is still there. You know, one of the things I'm going to do is take people to a house called the Pickering House, which was built in 1644. And remarkably, it's still owned by the Pickerings. This one family has lived there since 1644. And, of course, the house has changed over that much time. It's 350 years. But it's actually pretty original. I mean, anyway. When I take them there, they will explain the story, but that's when the place was built. It's amazing. But that's not what I want to talk about, of course. I want to talk about a stone. So I grew up specifically on Ord Street, O-R-D Street, in Salem, Massachusetts. Not famous in any way, probably named after a Civil War guy, we don't know. There's nothing notable about the neighborhood or anything, except that it's on the outskirts of Witchcraft Heights, which was, yes, Witchcraft Heights. I went to Witchcraft Heights Elementary School. It's true. This was a development built in the late 60s and the early 70s by a guy named DiBiase, this big, massive suburban complex on what used to be grazing land in the highest part of Salem, hence the name Heights. It literally was higher there. And my house was in like an older neighborhood right on the edge of all that new development, but it was a newer house. It was built at the same time as the development. None of that matters. What matters is that I lived at the top of a hill, and we would race whatever we could down the hill. So big wheels were the thing for most of my childhood. You wanted to get a big wheel, and you'd race down the street, hopefully the sidewalk, and then do a spin out at the end of the street. We did that for hours and hours and hours, day on end, for years. Me and all the other kids in the neighborhood, that's what we did. Now, at the end of the hill, down on the sidewalk, past three houses that were built around 1970, there was a stone. And it's a little hard to describe, but basically, there were these three new houses, and then an older house that was built in 1895, that I actually looked up and know that. And in between the 1895 house and the 1970 house, the last one, where the land got flat again, there was a stone. The stone was about 4 feet long and 2 feet wide, and it was this piece of granite, I think. And someone had carved grooves into it, a lot of grooves, and they were chipped in there by hand. And you could tell it was by hand because they were uneven. Someone spent a lot of time working on this stone. So there's probably 20 different horizontal grooves and then two vertical grooves on one side. And the stone is just sitting there in the lawn, basically, between these two houses. And there's a hole in it. And when I was very young, like 1972 or so, there was a metal pipe sticking out of that pole that, at the time, I thought was very tall. But I was maybe 3.5 feet tall, so I don't know, it could have been 4 feet tall. Because I knew it as a kid, I can't tell you actually how tall it was. But it was taller than me. And it was firmly in there, and we used to swing around on it. And even as a kid, I was like, what the heck is this? I mean, it didn't match anything else in the neighborhood. There were the late 19th century homes, and there were the late 20th century homes that I was living in, and then this stone that seemed much older. And it's become an obsession now. I'm 55 years now wondering about this stone, and I'm going to find out what this thing is. It looks like it could be a stepping stone. It looks like it could be a wash stone, because people used to wash their clothes in the river, right? And you'd have the stone, and you'd wash your clothes on it, because this thing does look like a big washboard. But the question you should be asking, except that you don't actually know where I'm talking about, is, but there's no river there. Except there was. So I've been looking at old maps, and indeed, there was a river there, or at least a brook. Right where that stone is, there was a tributary to what is called Strongwater Brook, which at one time was a very important waterway because it powered a lot of mills on the Peabody-Salem border. And yes, it's Peabody, not Peabody. It's Peabody. We say things weird. This stone was right at the edge of that water. So could it be that this was actually a colonial washing stone from maybe even the 17th century? I don't know. The pipe is a problem, because if there was a pipe in there, well, iron pipes didn't exist in the 17th century, at least not like that, and they certainly wouldn't have lasted. So my latest thought on that is that someone just stuck a pipe in there because there was a hole. People do like to stick things in holes, I've noticed. And, well, someone may have found a pipe and just stuck it in there and it's like, oh, look at that. You know, I don't know. I don't know that I'll ever know. But there is a hole in there. If the hole is unrelated to the pipe, what could it have been for? And, well, I've got three thoughts on that. The first thought is that the pipe may have been just in the hole, but the hole was there for a boot scraper, which are very common in Salem. If you go down on Essex Street and Chestnut Street in the historic part of town, you'll see a lot of the homes have boot scrapers on their stairs and on their stoops. And basically, the streets were made of mud for hundreds of years. And before you went into someone's house, you would scrape your boots off on these. They look like metal putty knives sticking up. And if you're from New England, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But if you're from, say, L.A., you've probably never seen one of these things. But yeah, that they're common in old colonial towns. And this could have been where one of those was mounted. That's thought number one. Thought number two, much simpler, Occam's razor kind of simpler. It's where they picked up the stone. You will find in a lot of old stoneworks that there were holes or indentations placed where they could grab onto the stone with some kind of equipment and move it. So that's possible too. But the position of the hole is not symmetrical with anything. It's up in, if you divide the rectangle into quadrants, it's up in one quadrant, just kind of, it's just a hole there. It doesn't seem to match anything. It's not lined up with the grooves or anything. It's just a hole. And it looks like it was a hand-chiseled hole. It does not look drilled. It's definitely not modern. And my latest idea is that, what if that was where a well head was, a pump? Maybe people were getting water from this brook, and rather than like kneel down with a bucket or whatever, they actually had created a pump. And this was like the village pump. And they would pump, and then the water would come out on the stone, which was grooved, so it wouldn't be slippery, and maybe could also be used for laundry. I don't know. I'm going to try to find out, though. I know somebody out there who is familiar with colonial architecture and old building styles in New England knows what this thing is. I do not think it's pre-colonial. I think it's definitely colonial. This came from a quarry. This wasn't a rock that was found in place that somebody worked. It was definitely quarried. There are lots and lots of quarries, even back in the 17th century New England. So I don't know. I have this goal now, this obsession of finding out what this is. And I'll have a link in the show notes of the Google Maps street view of it. You can actually see it from street view. And have a look and see what you think. If you have any ideas, please let me know. I'm going to have to plan a trip to Salem and just go and ask everybody I can. I'll go to the library. I'll go to the Peabody Essex Museum. I don't even know. I'm already trolling Facebook groups, just hoping I find that one person who says, oh, yeah, that's a blah, blah, blah. And then I can try to figure out why it's there. Because when I look back at old maps, there weren't any houses there until the late 1800s. In fact, that stone kind of marks where the street ended. On some maps, that is where Ord Street, the street I lived on, ended. It ended right there. It extends much further now. But back then, it ended basically where the stone is. Is that significant? I don't know. Does it matter? I don't think so. But boy, I really want to solve this problem. And that is my latest of many, many obsessions. And, well, you know, I'm going to be turning 60 this year. I'm running out of time. I have a life's goal of figuring out what the heck that thing is. A place to visit. Speaking of stones, I did warn you there would be a lot of stones in this episode. I was just on Menorca, which is an island in the... I just learned this. It's in the Balearic Islands, okay? So in the Western Mediterranean, you have the Balearic Islands, which include Majorca, major, Menorca, minor, and Ibiza, below decks kind of party spot for rich young yacht people that I was very happy to skip. There's also another little island called Formentera. I didn't go to either Ibiza or Formentera, and that's fine. I went to Majorca and Menorca. And on Menorca, which I found out the islands of Majorca and Menorca are part of another sub-island chain called the Gymnesian Islands, which I'm pretty sure means naked islands. Anyway, I don't want to get too much into the weeds here. That is the Catalan word for the islands. Doesn't matter. Anyway, I was on Menorca, and I happened to be there with a YouTube star and very interesting guy named Flint Dibble. Flint Dibble came on the cruise with us, and he was a delight, and he knew a lot about the archaeology of Majorca and Menorca, and I'm not even going to try to tell you all the stuff he told us, because he was way, 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 way beyond anything that I could even approach in his expertise. But he did take us to this place that was pretty cool, And I saw something I didn't even know existed. And this is one of the fun things about travel, especially after you've done a lot of it, is to find weird, interesting things that you didn't even know existed. And so you have heard of Stonehenge, right? This was not like that, but it was a megalith like Stonehenge, much newer in the time scale of things, but pretty interesting. So apparently 400, 500 BC, this culture existed that built these stone structures. Now, these were not like Stonehenge. They didn't look like that, but they were similar stature. They were about as tall, and they weren't in a ring. Well, that's not true. They were in a horseshoe-shaped wall. They built a wall of rocks that was shaped like a horseshoe, and then in the middle, imagine the monolith from 2001, and then put another monolith on top of it, like a table. In fact, that's what taula means. Yeah, this is the taula, T-A-U-L-A, of the Taliotic culture. Taula means table in Catalan. And yeah, it looks like a table, but it's like 12 feet tall. And it's just sitting there, and, you know, there's sheep grazing and stuff, and it has been there for forever, and no one really knows anything about this culture other than what they're figuring out, and there hasn't been that much archaeology done on it. There has been some, but he took us around here, and there was a whole bunch going on. There's this big rock, and then there were other little buildings, and some of them were underground, and, you know, what does it mean? Why were these here? And of course, you know, well, this was an ancient ritual site. Yeah, okay, that's what you say when you don't know what it is. I mean, you could be right, but you might not be right. This may have had an actual practical purpose. Who knows? Maybe it was like if wolves were attacking, you could get up on top of this rock and they couldn't get up there, right? Probably not on Menorca, but you know what I mean. We don't actually know what it was for. People can speculate all they want. But there were several of these, and most of them have fallen down. The one that we saw was in good shape. It was the best one. And if you go to Menorca and you go on a tour, this is the one they will take you to. And it's pretty cool. And you can actually figure some things out, too, because, okay, you've got the monolith with the monolith on top. It's gray, not black, and it's not shiny. It's clearly chiseled rock. But it's not rectangular. It's actually trapezoidal. It's a very long trapezoid. It's narrower at the bottom, which is interesting. And then on one side of it, there is this piece of rock that protrudes that actually gives it strength. So it has a spine. It's really interesting. And it was one of these things that I didn't really know was there. I mean, I know there's megaliths all over the world, and there's all different theories and hypotheses about how they got there. But this one was really kind of cool. And Flint was able to show us it was part of a whole structure. And there's other stone structures on the islands that were older, and they may have been signal towers. It seems like the people who lived there had a way to talk to other people on the island with these towers, whether they lit fires or waved things. Or I don't know, and I don't know that anybody does, but that was there too. And having just been to Malta, I can see a reason for this, because Malta is primarily two islands that are populated. You have Malta and Gozo, and Gozo is a smaller island. And throughout history, Gozo had been raided by Barbary pirates and other people and had their entire population taken away to serve as slaves. So there was motivation to make sure nobody was coming for you. Maybe that's what the towers were for? I don't know. At any rate, if you happen to be in that part of the Mediterranean, I loved Menorca, and I am encouraging you to visit. And yes, there is van life there. You can take a ferry. This would be an awesome place to do van life. Everybody was super friendly. It's a very chill island. Yeah, it's a little touristy in some parts down by the port, but not that much. Nothing like the Caribbean. You could have a very affordable, really chill experience here, and you get to spend some time with these massive stones and just ponder why they're there. And how long are they going to be there after you're not here anymore? Resource recommendation. I got to talk about AI again. I know, and I agree, but AI is not completely useless, and it also isn't completely wrong all the time. That's the truth. You may disagree with me, and that's fine. You don't have to use AI. However, these days, as somebody who has spent most of his life looking for unusual places to visit, I now start with AI. And the reason is that it can do things faster and better than I can. So the way I've been doing it for years was to go to known websites like Roadside America and Atlas Obscura and Weird New Jersey. And, you know, I've got this list of websites that are directories of weird places. And those are great, and I love them, and I've subscribed to them, and I will continue to give them money and use their products. They're all excellent. But AI does something that they can't, which is that it aggregates them. AI will basically go out and search the web. It'll search Reddit and search the web and find all these things and then put them in context. So I can just do searches like I could never do with those sites. For example, let's do this right now. Okay, I'm going to go to ChatGPT just because it's easy. I'm not advocating for any over the others. It's like, and this is what I'm going to type. I'm going to Coventry, Rhode Island. What unusual things can I see there? Okay, that's it. That's all I'm going to start with that. And it told me to go visit the Nathaniel Greene Homestead, home of Revolutionary War General Nathaniel Greene. And this is interesting. It says, the whole town of Coventry has an abandoned village mill ghost feeling because there's all these old dams and colonial cemeteries and forgotten industrial remnants. It's, okay, that's interesting. There are old cellar holes, mill ponds, abandoned foundations, tiny cemeteries now in the forest. It is very gothic New England. Nearby is Rice City Pond. There is the Payne House Museum, which tells you about local history. There's a wildlife refuge. There's Candy's Curiosity and Vintage's Oddities, an oddity shop. By the way, these are getting more common. There's one in LaSalle now. There's a great new one in Burlington, Vermont, right on Church Street. I'm happy about this. I love these places. And there is the Lovecraft Arts and Sciences Council, which is described as an art gallery. Yes, that Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft, the author of really gothic horror and Nazi sympathizer, as it happens. So that is all stuff that I didn't know was there. Now let me go to Roadside America and see what it says as a comparison, because that Roadside America has been my number one go-to for years and years and years, and it will continue to be. So I'm going to type in Coventry, Rhode Island, and it says, I can't find anything in Coventry, Rhode Island. So how do you like that? Now, I could go to the map on Roadside America and find things kind of in the area, but that's more work, right? All right, so let's look at Atlas Obscura, Coventry, Rhode Island. And I'm a little upset with Atlas Obscura right now because they've really hidden the map. It's really hard to find the map. Okay, so Atlas Obscura, I typed in Coventry, Rhode Island, Coventry, R.I., just to be specific, and it brought up just nothing. It brought up La Gloria, Mexico, Little Boy Zero, the Mona Lisa of Grodno, which is in Belarus, Lightning Ridge. The search is just, it doesn't work. Let me try Coventry, Rhode Island, spell out Rhode Island. Okay, so it doesn't like R.I., it liked Rhode Island. See, and this is one of the things about AI. It understands the context that R.I. means Rhode Island, where these old traditional search engines, they would have to code that in, that R.I. means Rhode Island, and they apparently didn't at Atlas Obscura. So, well, okay, so let's see. Nope. The closest thing it found was in West Warwick, which isn't that close, and it is a shrine for the Station Fire. Oh, yeah, that fire that when Great White was playing, I remember that. That's it. Everything else is quite a bit far away, although in Exeter, Rhode Island, there is the final resting place of New England's last vampire, which might actually be worth a trip. Anyway, you get the point here. By using AI to do this search, I found things that I can't find any other way. And while not all of them are interesting, it actually gave me the list, brought up a map, gave me their reviews. I can click on things and see them, and it's just more information. Ultimately, I'm going to decide where I want to go, but it helped me find these things that I didn't even know were there. So I'm sorry, Atlas Obscura and Roadside America, as much as I love you guys, and I will continue to support you, AI right now is doing a better job of showing me things to visit. And sure, nobody at the AI company is doing the work of creating these directories and vetting these places and all that. They're just going out there and searching and aggregating them. But, geez, it's so valuable, I can't ignore it. Anyway, I offer you that. If you are somebody who never wants to use AI for whatever reasons, I think that's fine. I have no argument with that at all. But if you're somebody like me who wants to get the most information possible, AI is kind of an essential tool right now. And you've got the data. You do what you want to do. I'm never going to criticize you for it one way or the other. My job here is to give you guys options. And I think AI is offering a lot of new options these days. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 294. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. If you need to get a hold of me for any reason, please find me at builttogo.com, where you can find the Discord server, the Facebook group, etc. Until next time, remember the words of Jack Kerouac, who said, "They have worries. They're counting the miles. They're thinking about where to sleep tonight, how much money for gas, the weather, how they'll get there. And all the time, they'll get there. Anyway, you see."